brother. What's up?
This is a Cuban party, man.
Yeah, brother, like, solid. Right on.
Welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. You know, it's that time again. I just love having conversations with this brilliant man and a good friend who I think just gets better every time, you know, we grace these airways. And I'm so happy and excited that Sandy Williams and I are. Who was it, Sandy, that said back in the saddle again?
Was that Roy Rogers?
Yeah.
Roy. He's back in the saddle.
People are saying, Roy who?
Yeah, exactly. they should remember Dale Evans.
Yeah, Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. Yeah. You know, man, we're a couple of grizzled old guys, man. We're talking about Roy Rogers and Dale Evans in 2025.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, that's who we are, right? I mean, we can't change that.
Well, grizzled guys, you know, at least we have long memories. We have long teeth, long in the tooth, and maybe long memories.
Hey, and white hair and white beards, yeah. And, you know.
Yeah, we've earned this.
Yeah. You know? Well, man, it's good. Always good to see you. Always good to have dialogue and conversation with you because we cover a whole different array of things. But today is no different. You know, Sandy, I remember early conversations with you when we first met and started having conversations. And one of those conversations I'll never forget, and it was you mentioning about how America got to be as powerful a nation as it did. And you pointed out that the rest of the world was kind of destroyed their infrastructure after World War II, and that America was left as the lone manufacturer, because we produced everything in this country. We were self-absorbed. We didn't need anybody else. Whatever it was, I don't care if it was, you know, television, sewing machines, whatever it was, refrigerators, washers, all those things we produced. And so it fostered a middle-class lifestyle for our nation for quite a while, and we didn't need the rest of the nations.
You know, the rest of the world had things like the Chinese built the Great Wall long, long ago to protect themselves. The French had the Maginot Line, which was designed to keep Germany from ever being able to invade, as they had in World War I. And we were different. We had the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, two of the biggest moats you could ever imagine to protect the castle of America. And those moats, particularly in World War II, preserved us. Yes, we participated in World War II by sending fighters abroad to fight, but other than the attack on Pearl Harbor, which was deemed to be our shores, but out in the middle of the Pacific, America was untouched by the damage that all of Europe experienced so deeply, and Asia. I mean, Japan was destroyed, Germany was destroyed, Russia was destroyed, all of Europe was vanquished by Germany, and none of its manufacturing processes survived the bombings of the United States of Europe in order to secure the victory over Germany. All of that resulted in a period of time when the U.S. economy was thriving during World War II, building the munitions for the rest of the world to fight the war, and then immediately being able to move that munition manufacturing into the production of goods and of goods to be sold around the world. In 1950, the United States was essentially the China of the rest of the world. We were producing more than 17% of the goods that were exported around the world, which is a larger percentage than China does today. Our trade surplus on a relative basis was a bigger percentage of the total world trade than the trade surplus being experienced by China today as a percentage of total world trade. Now, the numbers are significantly different. The size of the trade surpluses of the United States was counted in single-digit billions, and the size of the Chinese trade surplus right now is $1 trillion. It just set a record. But still, it should be remembered that the United States, at the end of World War II, We were the lone economy standing. We were supplying the rest of the world with goods and services, and we had decided that it was in our interest to forge a world that could revive quickly so that they could buy our goods and services and pay for them. And we were the prime architect and forged a deal called the Bretton Woods Agreement, which was initiated during World War II in 1944 in a little town in New Hampshire where the Allied forces met to discuss what the world economic order would be after World War II. And the Bretton Woods Treaty was then signed in 1945. And it, for a long period of time, until the 1970s, was the basis for the U.S. dollar being the world reserve currency and the U.S. being the dominant economy in the world.
So the reason all of this is so important and that we go back to that, you know, foundation, Sandy, to move forward our conversation today, and that conversation is centered around, you know, the dismantling of that accord you just talked about and our relationship with the European allies and NATO. And it looks for all the world like we are kind of moving away from that corridor and moving towards, you know, getting engaged and involved in what's going on in Colombia and Venezuela. And so Donald Trump has unilaterally made that kind of decision to move. Sandy, your thoughts on these things?
Well, you know, the confluence between economic policy and world policy, the way we face and address the rest of the world, are intertwined in ways that we don't even necessarily clearly understand. But there's no question that there is a continuum between military policy, foreign policy, and economic policy, and all of them are tied together. Ever since the demise of Bretton Woods, and what happened to kill Bretton Woods was that a basis of it was that the dollar was to be pegged to gold at the rate of $35 an ounce. And any foreign country that held dollars was able to turn around and demand from the United States gold from the United States at the price of $35 an ounce in exchange for dollars. And we made that promise. Not many countries ever called us on it. But we made that promise, and we were going to be able to support it unless and until there were too many dollars held by foreign countries such that we didn't have enough gold to support the demand for it. Were there to be a run on gold, as they would say, were the other countries to start to demand gold for dollars? And that condition developed by the 1960s. We were having big trade surpluses, much the way China has big trade surpluses, until about 1970. But we were running deficits in our budgets from 1950 on. We've never really been a country that balanced our budget since World War II, and it wasn't a problem, and not a big problem. Number one, when the deficit was a small percentage of our GDP, and number two, because we were the world reserve currency, we could basically print money and it would be supported by the rest of the world. But by the 1960s, people like Charles de Gaulle of France and others were beginning to question this right of the dollar to be supreme in the world. Countries began to talk about relinquishing dollars for gold. And by the time Nixon's presidency was in its second term, there was a clear realization that we couldn't sustain that promise. And so Nixon broke the promise and said, no longer will we convert dollars to gold. And the Bretton Woods Accord was therefore essentially broken in 1971 when Nixon said that. And with the break in that accord, the world economy entered a world of kind of free-for-all. The Bretton Woods Agreement had all kinds of rules associated with it. There were rules that allowed countries to restrict the investment by foreigners in their countries. It allowed countries to restrict the investment by their nationals in the capital of other countries. And those things were all designed to allow for this kind of free trade, but without the downsides associated with it. And whereas the United States viewed foreign investment by banks and others of the United States in foreign countries in their manufacturing processes, because they thought that was a good idea, because number one, it was rebuilding those countries and rebuilding them as economies that who could buy things from the United States, even though it was offshoring jobs. We were in full employment. We had no worry at the time. And number two, it was creating a profit stream that would flow back to the United States at a rate that was bigger, because the United States was participating in the rapid regrowth of the rest of the world economy, and many of them of companies in the United States decided they wanted to become multinational, because whereas the United States economy was growing at a pretty good rate, the rest of the world's economies were growing at a very rapid rate as they rose from the ashes coming out of World War II, and so we wanted to participate in that.
Finish your point.
Well, but by the 1970s, when Bretton Woods was broken, at that point, all these restrictions on the movement of capital also fell aside, because they were all being implemented in conjunction with the Bretton Woods Agreement. And so after 1971, not only did U.S. capital move freely for the purpose of building plants abroad, but the capital in the world was allowed to move freely to, for instance, speculate in currencies and to move currency values against one another in a way that might become, whereas it was economically efficient to do this, it also created volatility and instability. The dollar remained the most stable currency in that environment, and so has been able to survive as the world currency because, one, it has been more stable than other currencies, and two, we have this huge world market of very trusted financial instruments that people can invest in, which are the treasury instruments, the treasury debt instruments.
But Sandy, when did we go from gold to silver?
We didn't go to silver. The cross of gold and all of that was something that was the argument in the 1890s as to whether we would have gold and silver. But when we dropped the promise to convert to dollars to gold on a promised basis in 1971, we became what's called a fiat currency, which meant that our dollar is worth a dollar because we declare it's worth a dollar. But there is no backup to it. There is no gold backup to it. There is no reserve behind it.
So if that's the case, Andy, and it is, and since there's no where does the impetus to say that this dollar has value?
Well, like I said, it's by fiat. It's a bit like.
Sandy, I can't go to the bank.
Bitcoin. It has value because other people believe that it has value. The dollar has value today because it is a trusted form of exchange, and the trusted is the important word there. It's not supported by something other than trust.
So ideas.
The trust is built on our global leadership, the stability of our policies and what we do in year to year that's relatively predictable. It's based on our military leadership in the world, and it's based on the fact that we have this treasury instruments. We have a financial market which provides a place for those who are trading in things around the world to put their money and invest it in dollars, which is a stable form of investment, which provides a safe and stable form of return. All of those things have supported the reason for the rest of the world saying, yep, we're gonna say a dollar is worth a dollar. Now, because we are not pegged to gold, the ability of that dollar to inflate is much more unrestricted. So all of the currencies in the world have been inflating at a more rapid rate than they would have had we been pegged to gold, and had we restrained, for instance, the size of our deficits so that we could continue to meet the promise of exchanging a dollar at the rate of $35 an ounce. But the fact is that the supply of gold, while it does fluctuate and can grow, is relatively finite. It can't possibly grow infinitely, and it can't possibly grow at a rapid rate from year to year. So what happened really was that our domestic policies of large deficits caused us to create dollars at a rate that was far in excess of our capacity to meet any gold standard.
So, Sandy, 40 years or so ago, the pound was an instrument like that. But we look at the pound today, and it's lost that value.
Well,
are we headed down that same?
Well, pre-World War II, the pound was a significant world currency, rising essentially to the level of reserve currencies. Some of it had to do with the length and breadth of the British Commonwealth and the number of countries that were colonialized and using the pound. But the pound was a very powerful currency for all the reasons I just described. England was a powerful country. It had a huge financial market that was a place where the pound could be used. And other countries were of a belief that the pound had stability built within its value, and that when they weren't using the pound for trading purposes, they could invest the pound in the British financial markets. After World War II, the world literally adopted the dollar as its reserve currency in this Bretton Woods Agreement, supplanting the pound. But the dollar has since then provided all those same things that the pound used to provide prior to that. But of course, with the loss of its empire, Britain descended into being basically a service industry country, serving the rest of the world in financial markets, but at nowhere near the same level as the United States financial markets.
So, Sandy, after that history lesson, in order for all of those things to, and the redevelopment of Europe and all of those things that transpired and took place, it happened under the umbrella of America, basically saying anybody who attacks our allies, i.e. NATO, you're going to have to deal with us. And so they were able to invest and rebuild their nations and do the kind of things they did because of our relationship and our really umbrella. Is it safe to say that? Military umbrella.
Yes. I mean, the Marshall Plan, which was designed to send money to Europe to rebuild Europe and its infrastructure from the destruction of World War II, was a twofold plan. Yes, it was very good for Europe, and it had this sort of eleemosynary purpose of rebuilding Europe at the expense of some of the American budget. But the real background behind it, and the reason why it was able to get through Congress and be adopted, was it put money in the hands of the Europeans to buy products from the country in the world that was manufacturing products, which was the United States of America. And so we were essentially financing the sale of our products to the rest to Europe, which you have to understand, in 1950, Europe and Japan were the rest of the developed world. China wasn't viewed as a developed country. Russia and the Soviet Union was sort of a fenced-off backwater. And so Africa was a continent that was hardly touched. And so what did you have? I mean, you basically had the United States trying to rebuild the world marketplace for its products, which was Europe.
And Germany
and trying
being
to make
destroyed.
Sure that Europe stayed peaceful so they could do so.
So Sandy, and for all the reasons that we've just got through discussing, our relationship militarily with NATO and the friendship that has been built over all those decades that you're talking about I more than jeopardized with the new regime in the White House. And with all the things that I'm reading, Sandy, I don't know if this relationship, which is now just about to be severed, if, let's say, Trump and his regime leaves, I don't know if Eastern Europe, I mean, if Europe is going to be able to trust our nation again. Is it safe to say that there's some?
Well, I think trust is a big part of possibly what's being eroded here. When you decide you want to re-Balkanize the world, you want to re-blockade countries from one another and create fences around countries, particularly the United States, from a trade standpoint. You begin to break down what was the liberal view of the world, which was if the world is trading with one another and is interdependent upon one another economically, it is much less likely that they will poke one another in the eye with sticks, and there will be peace, a level of peace that will avoid warfare, at least between these nations who are so interdependent upon one another. And the notion that trade deficits and that are inherently bad, and that that trade deficits need to be fought in the same manner that you would fight the invasion of a foreign army, which is much like what the current policy being adopted discusses, the notion that we need to take all kinds of extraordinary steps and use our financial power and our military power in order to secure the economic outcome we're looking for, which is something like a closer to zero balance of payments with our international trade, as well as, and this is unfortunately what's being jeopardized by it, as well as maintaining the dollar as the dominant reserve currency in the world. And these two things sort of compete with one another. They aren't necessarily complementary to one another. And I'm afraid that the policy that wants to balkanize the rest of the world is a short-sighted one, not a long-sighted one. And the long sight of it will show that it might be jeopardizing the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency, which is a fundamental linchpin to the health of our economy, number one. And number two, by re-erecting the walls between countries, we will end up with a world in which each country tries to manufacture as much as possible of the goods and services that are used within the country, within each country. And what does that mean? Well, that means that U.S. businesses will be tied to the growth rate of the American economy as potential growth rate for their businesses. And one of the reasons that so many American businesses have become multinational global businesses is because the markets in the rest of the world are growing far more rapidly than the U.S. market. And so, you know, if a tariff policy that's designed to block imports from coming into the United States is actually successful, and the counterpart of that is that exports from the United States will become much harder to achieve, we will end up with an economy that is, again, unlike the post-World War II economy, which was growing rapidly because we were selling to the rest of the world, we will become an economy that is dependent on the growth rate of the U.S. economy itself.
So Sandy, is it looks for all the world that we're kind of moving more towards the Middle East and what's taking place there, and building partnerships and relationships with people who clearly several decades ago were classified as people we wouldn't even have these relationships with.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Ever since the OPEC nations formed their cartel in 1970, and ever since the Arab oil embargo of 73, we learned this lesson when we were so dependent on oil that we needed to make sure that we controlled the flow of oil in the world. And so the Carter Doctrine, adopted by Jimmy Carter in 1980, was basically that the Gulf nations, anyone who attempts to control the Gulf nations will be taking an act of war against the United States, because the United States said that it's vital to the U.S. security interests that the Gulf nations be independent from foreign control. And that was all about oil. And ever since 1980, we've had this oil view, this view of the world order, looked through a vision that is oil-filled goggles. And it's true today. Our policy with Venezuela is clearly all about the proposition that Venezuela has the largest
oil reserves
of any nation in the world. Okay, it is the most oil-rich country in the world. It's here in the Western Hemisphere, and the United States has decided to use its economic powers, its military powers, in order to basically assert and to try to assert the kind of control over Venezuela, which I would, I guess, mildly observe as the same sort of control which I think Russia is trying to assert over Ukraine, which is essentially that you must have a regime in Venezuela which is altogether lined up with and in tune with the policies of the United States.
But Sandy, that goes,
or else.
That goes back to what you just said about what former President Jimmy Carter said to other nations. We're doing that right now, right? I mean, the very thing that Jimmy Carter wanted other nations not to do, it looks like we're headed down that path.
Well, it's interesting because we're both taking a view that oil is a strategic resource, which is potentially and maybe inherently in short supply or in potential short supply. And therefore, we're forging world policies that relate almost entirely to the supply of oil. So nobody's really interested in the Gulf countries in the Mideast other than for the reason that the Gulf is filled with oil.
Right.
Okay, so it's an oil-rich region of the world, which is what makes it interesting to the rest of the world. And yet we also are adopting national policies to try and preserve that central influence on oil and gasoline, for instance, so that, you know, the current administration basically runs politically against electric vehicles, which are something that threatens the predominance of oil as an important asset in the world. And on the other hand, we're forging world policies because we're afraid of the scarcity of oil and the access of the United States to oil. And so oil is king, apparently. And it's an interesting phenomena. But ever since the start of time, if you look at the basis for world conflicts that have occurred, almost all of them relate in some fashion to economic tensions, mercantile trade tensions. You know, the people who are careful historians who look at the beginning of World War II and the attack by Japan on Pearl Harbor will point out that the Japanese were in many respects responding to an embargo that the United States had placed in the South Pacific on the transportation of oil into Japan, strangling Japan's capacity to receive oil, which in 1940 was a very fundamental resource for industry at large. And so it could be said that in some respects, our foreign policies triggered were acts of war in a fashion, economic war against Japan, which preempted and prompted them to take this preemptive strike.
But Sandy, correct me if I'm seeing this the wrong way, but our nation has been trying to move in a different direction as it relates to energy, away from oil, and looking at this in a whole different perspective, which is what we've kind of seen green energy and all those kind of things. We've been working on those things. And yet with the new regime, his thing is let's do away with all of that future planning. We're going back to what we know is, you know, where the power lies.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that Arab oil embargo of 1973, and those of us who lived through it, carpooled to work.
Yeah.
We instituted daylight savings time in the middle of winter to try and save oil. That Arab oil embargo woke the United States up to the fact that it was not necessarily good for us from a security standpoint to be dependent upon a resource like oil. And it began the process of moving towards renewable energy as a replacement for oil. So we should remember that, you know, some people would view renewable energy as something that we move towards in response to global warming and the strategic dangers that were posed by global climate change. But the fact is that renewable energy's initial impetus was simply to move away from oil as being a resource which could be the subject of world conflict and could put us in jeopardy in the circumstance in which we could get strangled of oil in much the same way that Japan felt that it was being strangled of oil in 1940.
So, Sandy, all of this conversation we're having right now leads me again back to what is transpiring, what is taking place right now, where we are headed towards going back to yesterday. And the leadership that we have right now is moving in that direction, while Congress has been silent and allowing this unilateral movement to happen that's taken our nation back to a different time.
Well, it's back to a time that's almost unrecorded in terms of, you know, modern times is basically viewed as being World War II till now. And
right.
Pre-World War II was a much different world order. And it was a world order that led into World War I and World War II. By the nature of the conflicts that existed between nations. And many of those conflicts were the result of mercantile and economic friction that created the environment that made, number one, caused some countries to go into economic collapse, which triggered movements in the direction of autocracy and the kind of autocracy that led to Mussolini and Hitler and the fascist leaders of World War II. And the other thing was that it was just economic tension between the countries that caused countries to feel like they needed to cross swords as sort of either the first or last resort of the form of economic warfare that they were participating in, which was dominated by tariff wars, but also by further and other kinds of restrictions on commerce. Embargoes, for instance. I mean, you know, we developed
the
navies.
The Arab oil embargo,
other countries developed navies in the late 1800s. Much of it was to be able to control trade on the high seas. And by controlling trade, I'm talking about being able to blockade trade and to be able to coerce trade to flow in the directions that were of economic value to the countries that had large navies.
So, Sandy, we basically accosted an oil tanker of Venezuela's in waters that we don't control. And we took that oil tanker, the United States government took it as if it was ours. We said we controlled their airspace. And so these are acts of war. If anybody else did that, any other nation did that, we would be outraged. We would be up in arms.
Well, yeah, I mean, we announced a blockade of the shipments of oil in and out of Venezuela. We also shut down their airspace. We've been conducting military activity in the form of blowing up these boats in international waters and in the national waters of Venezuela. And so, yeah, these are technically all acts of war. Which, you know, normally those kinds of acts of war require acts of Congress to initiate. And there are those in Congress, Rand Paul and others, who are standing up and saying, hey, this is the province of Congress. And unless and until you can actually describe the emergency to the immediate emergency to U.S. security that you are responding to by this conduct, we in Congress need to exercise our legitimate powers over this conduct. But, you know, one of the things that will be marked by history will be the extremely aggressive use of executive orders being used by the current administration. I mean, it's not quite at the rate of executive orders that were issued by Franklin Delano Roosevelt during his 12 years, which included the Depression and World War II, which were both situations of extreme national emergency, which certainly had clear justifications for things like executive orders. The current use of executive orders has essentially let Congress sit on its hands. Almost none of what has happened in the last year in the way of remarkable changes to things have been the result of congressional action. Tariffs have changed the international landscape, have started to re-Balkanize and re-blockade countries from one another in the trading process, has caused the American consumer to have to pay the price of tariffs, and regardless of what might be announced and the notion that foreign countries or foreign governments are somehow bearing the brunt of tariffs, the fact is that economic analysis establishes that essentially all of tariffs that are paid by the importer and the importing country's customers. And certainly in the short term, that's the case. But so we have a remarkable change in world order. And this is in an environment which is accelerating the rate at which the world order that existed under Bretton Woods is now transforming itself into a world order that is the result of the exertion of power, the exercise of power by a couple of countries, those countries primarily being China and the United States, and the flexing of their powers, China and the United States, and those powers relate to economic power and military power and the blend of the two. And it was the United States that began probably to most aggressively use its economic power in a fashion that related to military conduct with the imposition of sanctions that we have exercised in various situations around the world, sanctioning whole countries and whole regions for conduct and using the power of the dollar to make those sanctions sting. And so a lot of what's going on is causing the rest of the world to say, you know, this reliance on the dollar has come with a price now that we didn't used to see under the old Bretton Woods condition. And we're beginning to worry about the extent to which the dollar's dominance is going to be the result of the exercise of coercion and military power or economic power, as well as simply the result of economics.
So, Sandy, you spoke about Congress. The House will vote today. It's voting today on a resolution that would pump the brakes on Trump's march to war with Venezuela. They're voting today on that because they're concerned about Trump dragging us into war. And I don't think the American people really know, you know, because, you know, to be quite frank with you, what has happened is our news media outlets, for the most part, They're kind of, well, we really don't want to get too much into that and we just don't want to. But Sandy, they've got to get into this, right?
Well, I think the hope has been on the part of the administration that, much the way I think Putin calculated that Ukraine would fall immediately and it could simply be a special military action instead of a war, the United States' conduct in South America has typically involved very short kinds of bursts of activity. Right. Much of it has been covert. The CIA creating the downfall of Allende and the installation of Pinochet as the head of Chile, the conduct we've carried out in Guatemala, Honduras, a variety of countries, the gunboat diplomacy of going back to Teddy Roosevelt, just having some gunboats appear on the shore, have caused changes in administrations and countries and changes in policies. And I think this is sort of a modern day version of the Teddy Roosevelt gunboat diplomacy. The idea being that with a brief burst of pressure applied in various ways upon the Maduro administration in Venezuela, they will get Maduro to step down, and they'll be in a position to make sure that the reinstalled leader of Venezuela, whoever that might be, will be someone who will be entirely sympathetic to the U.S. interests in Venezuela, which obviously highly center around, you guessed it, oil.
Well, Sandy, look at what happened in Libya with Muammar Gaddafi. And so people, we don't talk about it, but clearly what transpired there, we had a hand in it.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And look at what happened to Libya and the people and that nation after that happened. No leadership ever came back. And the vacuum still exists today.
Well, that's been the danger of the notion of U.S. nation building, or trying to guide nation building. The Maidan revolution, as it's called in Ukraine, obviously had U.S. CIA and U.S. government fingerprints built into it. The Muammar Gaddafi bombings and the result of the demise of his administration had our fingerprints, and that upset the stability not just in Libya but in Somalia and some other countries that became power vacuums. What happened in Iraq was the same thing.
Right.
We were going to nation build in Iraq. We've created a vacuum in which there's been chaos and anarchy ever since. And the same has happened in South America. I mean, if you look at the history of Chile, that Pinochet administration was basically fraught with problems and didn't really do well by the Chileans. We helped install the Shah of
Iran.
Of Iran,
yeah.
And that has upset the Mideast probably ever since the conduct of that in 1953. So our efforts to tinker and nation build have not played out well. But what they have done is they've allowed our government to act surreptitiously and without congressional action, because what we've done has been, one, surreptitious, and number two, quick, okay, so that by the time Congress wakes up and sees what's going on, it's already happened.
So, Sandy,
and there's not much time.
Let me ask you, because this historical perspective that you are painting makes me stop and think. If I'm Russia and Putin right now, and the United States continues to tell me that I'm a bully and that what I'm doing in Ukraine is inhumane, and Putin knows our history, right?
Yeah, well,
and he's saying, hey, wait a minute. You can't tell me anything. I know your history.
Well, these are the talking points of Russia. You know, they will point this out. But the rest of the world has been in league with us in large part. I mean, the French continue to dabble in Africa and continue to try and profit
from
the colonial kind of influence that they have. I mean, the West has in large part spent a long period of time tinkering with the rest of the world for its own purposes, and frequently those own purposes relate to natural resource value that might be found in the countries and the exploitation of it. So that the fact is that the Shah Pahlavi was installed over almost a decade in Iran in 1953, and that was an oil controversy. Mossadegh was on the verge of nationalizing the Iranian oil business. And the Venezuela conflict, for whatever people want to say and point at drugs, the fact is that Venezuela is not a main source of drug trafficking in the world. It's nowhere near the same level as Mexico or Colombia,
right,
or some of the other countries that are primary in it, or for that matter, Afghanistan in the east. But it definitely has a lot of oil, and it's definitely of great interest there. And it's been using its capacity for oil, even to the extent we've tried to cripple it. It's been using it to try to support Cuba and a couple of other countries that are viewed as being outliers by the United States.
Now, well, you know, Sandy, when
Cuba Cuba lacks strategic value to the United States, other than the extent to which it has a lot of political value. The likes of Marco Rubio and others, the transplanted Cubans in the United States who were transplanted because of the installation of communism in Cuba, continue to have a great deal of interest in trying to reinstate a government in Cuba which is pro-West instead of the communist government that exists.
You know, Sandy, and because the history of what you are just talking about is not something that we teach in this nation. You think about Venezuela and 30 years ago. Who was the guy president then? I can't remember his name.
Of Venezuela?
Yes.
Chavez.
And then because he was nationalizing their oil. And he was making sure that the people got to benefit from that oil, the same way Gaddafi was in Libya. And so we've clearly did some things, Sandy, that aren't right. But I think the American people should be aware, because this movement that's taking place right now, because we don't know the history, we may not be so focused on what is transpiring. Our military has said that any other tankers that are moving through there, we're going to take them as well. So, Sandy, come on. The impact to other nations, the impact to other nations that use that oil is tremendous.
One of the things that's, I suppose, sort of high points a potential hypocrisy of our foreign policies has been that we talk about lining up with countries that are aligned with us philosophically and are aligned with us from the standpoint of favoring democracy and favoring the rights, the civil rights of their citizens over the other things. We are against corrupt regimes, we say.
Right.
We're against corruption that involves the exploitation of the people at their own expense. But when we line up with other countries, for instance, when we line up with Saudi Arabia, there's nothing exemplary about the way Saudi Arabia runs its country for the benefit of its people. Saudi Arabia is a monarchy. It's a monarchy in which the royal family essentially owns the country. It's a country that carries out more executions and probably is more repressive in the way it deals with its people than many other countries in the world, but we view it as a strong ally, and we don't talk about those problems associated with that country. And similarly, in South America, there are countries that probably are operating at something closer to a democracy, but South America is rife with corruption. But we don't worry about the corruption and the problems in many of the countries, but we do worry about it, apparently, in some countries that might, for instance, have significant natural resources that would be valuable to us. And so, you know, the fact is that, like I said earlier, our foreign policy is very tightly tied up with our economic interests and our economic policies, and it's not very closely aligned, actually, with what we talk about, which is being aligned with countries who are like us and who share our democratic values. The fact is that the countries in the world who are most like us and share our democratic values are in Western Europe and reside in the European Union and are in that part of the world which we are rapidly disassociating ourselves from and allowing them to live and let live and to sort of figure it out on their own.
You know, Sandy, you just always make me think, you know, you talk about Saudi Arabia and, you know, and so got a great relationship with Saudi Arabia, you know, Donald Trump and his family and all those kind of things.
Well, it's not just Trump.
So, I know, but what's the difference between Saudi Arabia and Iran? Okay, well, we hate the Iranians. We can't have any relationship with them. They're our arch enemies. What's different about from Iran than Saudi Arabia as it relates to, you know, Saudi Arabia's done some terrorist things themselves.
Well, Saudi, yes. I mean, it probably this all probably relates to policy vis-a-vis Israel, but it's a bit of a chicken and the egg, because if we were cozy with Iran in the same way that we're cozy with Saudi Arabia, arming them with our military, with our Air Force capabilities, arming them with our all of the kind of sophisticated munitions that we now sell to Saudi Arabia, that does create a client status. If you are a country that is dependent upon our military hardware, you are dependent upon us, and you don't want to go to war with in a manner that would be contrary to our interests, because you won't get the parts you need and you won't get the support you need to run your military if you aren't lined up with us. So ever since World War II, both the Soviet Union and the United States used to talk about their client states, and what they really meant was their customer states. If a customer state was dependent upon your military hardware, they were dependent upon you. And if we had that relationship with Iran might well have a different policy vis-a-vis Israel than they currently do, but we don't, and we haven't ever since the fall of the Shah, which you know, was a fall that was extremely acrimonious towards the United States, because the Shah was in fact our pawn.
Horrible
and
guy.
It was viewed by that by the Iranian mullahs and others who took control.
So, Sandy, if you had a crystal ball, and with all of your historical knowledge, and you watch where this thing is headed right now, clearly the president of Venezuela is going to walk away. He has no choice. You know, we've got all that military might over there, and we're posturing. But if things don't happen the way we want them, it'll become more than posture. Is it safe to say that?
Well, I do believe that they will be tightening the screws in every conceivable way. I suspect that they already probably have told Maduro that he might be literally in the crosshairs of what we call wet work in the business in terms of potential assassination. I'm sure that he will be told in every way possible that his power and even his life is in jeopardy if he doesn't move out.
Hey, Sandy, assassinating a sitting president is not... come on, that's against international law, isn't it?
Well, I would point out that Salvador Allende committed suicide within hours of his deposition from power by Pinochet in something that was clearly hatched, at least with constructive support from the CIA and the United States. I don't know. I mean, I'm conjecturing about assassinating Maduro, but I'm confident they're tightening the screws on him in ways which ultimately, and I think maybe rapidly, will become hard for him to resist. And, you know, so, yeah, I suspect that there will be a change of power there. My concern about the shift away from Bretton Woods and this move towards a new world order that involves fences around every country dependent upon tariffs, and the desire that to create a much more of a laissez-faire, each man for himself kind of a world, that is based on what this new policy that was a policy paper that was issued a couple of weeks ago by the administration, that basically says, hey, we're going to go back to this real politic of Henry Kissinger, that is basically based on the world order of the power of major power centers, China, the United States, to some extent Russia, and that the United States will have the Western Hemisphere as its ledger domain, that China will have something like the South China Sea, and that will be an area that will be recognized, and Europe will be over there to work on its own order itself. And to deal with the rest of the world in that fashion. And that kind of a world is going to be much more prone to fall back into conflict with itself, number one. Number two, we'll end up, the United States, as I said before, being a marketplace that will have to depend upon itself. We'll have it will become a world in which if you want to sell something in India, you build a factory in India. If you want to sell something in China, you build a factory in China. If you want to sell something in the United States, you build a factory in the United States. And that kind of a world will not be a world in which the American businesses will be able to thrive in the same manner as they have, because they will be dependent on their growth of their own country.
So, Sandy, China's not going back, you know, to a time 60, 70 years ago. They're not going back there. There's nothing we can do to force them to go back, right? And so our nation's not getting any larger, Sandy, population-wise. This whole belief that America first and America last, and we're just going to be America and we're out here an island unto ourselves, that's backwards thinking, Sandy.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is the current political thrust of the conservatives, at least, is that, number one, we'll build a fence around the United States. It'll be tariff-based. It'll also be a geographic fence associated with migrations of population. And so, you know, the growth of the United States, you know, when you and I were young, the United States was 220 million. Now it's almost 350 million. It's grown quite a bit. But much of that growth has been dependent on in-migration, on immigrants that
right.
come into the United States. So if you shut down immigrants, but you want the country to grow, well, what do you need? Well, there's also this movement in the conservatives, which is called neonatalism, which is designed to cause the current people in the United States to have much bigger families. Let's get growing. Let's have indigenous growth.
Yeah.
let's have growth of people who look like us.
Yes.
That's a bona fide stated policy. The likes of our Vice President Vance talks lots about the fact that we need to make sure that our society, that our culture doesn't die. And the way we're going to make sure that's the case is we all need to have bigger families. And it's not necessarily true that we're going to find ways to support those bigger families financially, other than hanging a carrot out in front of mom and dad to have a baby, which will deliver a $1,000 premium upon birth. But will we provide daycare for that child so the parents can work and afford it? Well, not so much. Will we provide jobs that will allow a single family or earner to bring that family into the middle class? We don't have a policy for that. How about health care? Is health care going to be attended to? That's apparently tomorrow's problem.
You know, Sandy, we just painted a picture over this last hour. My fear is that not enough American people are listening or hearing this as much as they should, and are not really engaged in this. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, they feel as though they don't have any control over it, and we're headed down this path, and there's no stopping it. Do you see it that way?
This is something that I think is a cycle, this tribalism, this notion that we need to preserve what we are and we need to protect who we are is really a very tribal kind of an instinct. And those instincts are heading in the direction of rebalkanizing the world, causing us to draw boundaries between ourselves and then to protect those boundaries as a matter of social and cultural importance. And then we have economic policies that are constrained within those boundaries, but which are really probably limited in their capacity to have success without reaching outside the boundaries for what's necessary to achieve the success, which is how we end up with military conflict. So my concern is that we're setting the stage. You know, some people will say, well, don't worry, people, it's only going to be bots fighting one another in the future, and they'll settle it in some kind of a virtual world. But I am concerned that we're headed in a direction of a couple of things. One, we're putting the United States dollar as the reserve currency in jeopardy with our policies because we're creating more and more incentives for other countries to find other solutions for their trading policy. And as we get into digital currencies, if the digital currency of the world is not a dollar-backed digital currency with a stable coin that's dollar-backed, we'll really be in trouble financially in this country, because a great deal of the strength of this country is based on the strength of our financial markets. And the strength of our financial markets is strongly dependent upon the fact that the dollar is the ultimate currency being used by the world. And whether it's used directly as it is today or indirectly as a dollar-backed stablecoin type currency, in either case, it's going to be very important that it be primary. And we don't have the Bretton Woods Agreement anymore declaring it to be primary. So the only reason it's primary is the rest of the world looks at us and says the dollar is stable because the United States is a stable place. Its treasury instruments are stable. We view it as a dependable leader of the world. And much of what's going on right now is putting all of those suppositions at risk.
Sandy, great conversation as always. We have to leave it there, but we'll be back together soon.
Okay, good talking to you.
Thank you. Always great talking to you. That's the one and only Sandy Williams. See you guys the next time.